in our recent history. And so as a result, we had a lot of attention in comparison to previous cycles.
So I'm wondering, Dean, with the ramp up to the presidential primary getting longer and longer, and with the Granite State becoming more of a state up for grabs in the presidential contest, was there any sort of political burnout this year towards October, November, after nearly 18 months of nonstop political talk, political ads, political polls?
I think there always is to some extent. I've said for years that the last couple of weeks, a lot of the money spent on advertising is just basically wasted because people pretty much tune it out. I do think that campaigns have figured out quite effectively how to go where the voters are. So they've increasingly made campaigns part of a voter's kind of daily menu of social media, internet activity, cable news watching. It was interesting after the election to see how quickly the media outlets pivoted to talking about the next presidential election. Like, they didn't want to let it go, right? Because it's so good for ratings. They get such good audiences that there really is this sort of ongoing political culture now in which you're always talking about campaigns and elections. So, sure, I think there's always burnout. This was a close, exciting election. You saw how many people watched those presidential debates in the last few weeks, millions of people. But there's always a risk when you have this kind of media saturation environment in which the media can use technology to really go to where you are. So you have almost less of a say in whether or not you choose to be exposed to it, of burning out the voters a little bit.
So what did the results of the primary and the national contest say about the political makeup of the Granite State this time around, Dean? We've been a red state for decades. Then we kind of moved purple. Now some are arguing that we're becoming a blue state.
It's interesting. This is a question I get asked all the time about what is New Hampshire's political complexion. You know, there is some research showing that the state has trended increasingly Democratic in terms of voter registration since about 2000. So over the last 10 years of people moving into the state, more of them are registering as Democrats. We still have this very large group of independent voters, which is kind of always the big question mark here. I mean, I think for me, what the election pointed out in terms of New Hampshire is that we probably are trending a little bit more blue. There was a sense in 2010, because we had this big Tea Party-inspired Republican backlash, that New Hampshire is kind of schizophrenic. You know, it's blue for a few years, and then it's red for a few years, and then it's blue again. But the reality is that 2010, the people who voted, it was a different demographic than what we saw in 2012. So in 2010, the electorate in New Hampshire who voted were older, more conservative, and more focused on kind of the Tea Party message, right? So what we saw in 2012 was the Obama campaign and some of the Democratic campaigns in New Hampshire were very effective at not only turning out the Obama coalition from 2008, which was still here, just kind of disaffected in 2010, but adding to it with some new groups. So I'm not ready to say that we are a blue state in the traditional sense of New England, because we do have kind of a unique libertarian political culture here, which is a little more unpredictable. But I think what we saw in 2012 was that the basic fundamentals of that 08 Obama coalition are still here in the state. You know, for example, at the gubernatorial level, Maggie Hassan winning by 12 points. Clearly a sense that the Democratic coalition came roaring back in 2012. We didn't swing back and forth. They didn't show up in 2010.
Well, wonderful. Thank you very much, Dean. Look forward to working with you again in 2013, and have a happy new year.
Sure thing. Same to you, Keith.
Dean Spiliotis is civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University and author of the popular website nhpoliticalcapital.com. Politics was just as exciting in the State House in 2012. Throughout the year, there were major debates on issues that ranged from an educational funding amendment to a voter ID bill to an effort to repeal gay marriage. There were major party showdowns and the surprise resignation of House Majority Leader D.J. Betancourt. Also, Governor Lynch announced that he would not run for an unprecedented fifth term. That meant a new person would occupy the corner office, the first time in 8 years. The contest was called one of the biggest gubernatorial races of the year, and by September 11th, it was whittled down to two opponents, both attorneys. For the Democrats, it was Maggie Hassan from Exeter, and for the Republicans, it was Ovid Lamontagne from Manchester. Polls showed the race tight for months, but in the end, Hassan pulled out a significant win. As she was preparing to take office, I caught up with Governor-elect Hassan about what's gone on since her victory and her first plans after she takes office on January 3rd. Governor-elect Hassan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So back in early November, you won by a relatively large margin, and it was quickly pointed out that you're not only New Hampshire's second only woman governor, but currently the only Democratic woman governor in the nation. So as a woman, is there anything unique that you think you can bring to the governor's office?
Well, I think it's always really important to have a lot of perspectives at the table whenever you're tackling problems or just working together to get something done. And so I think women bring different experiences and perspective to whatever they do. And I think it's important to have men and women involved in governing. And I'll bring the perspectives that I have as a mother and a wife, also as a business attorney and as a former state senator to this office. And I'm very excited about what we can all do together moving forward.
Okay, so what's happened since the early November victory speech? What have you been doing to prepare to take office?
Well, we've been engaged in a transition process that is very compact and very exciting. We've been putting together our senior leadership team. What I'll be focused on as in the first 6 months, especially as governor, is balancing our budget and implementing the innovation plan that I talked about in the campaign. And that's a plan to make sure that we're creating jobs for the 21st century, that we have a skilled workforce for the 21st century economy, that we have the right kind of targeted tax credits, like an increase in the research and development tax credit for innovative businesses, and that we're giving technical assistance to our small businesses, not just that the government is helping small businesses in particular, but that we're finding ways to have strategic partnerships between colleges and universities and our businesses. So we've been focused on traveling around the state to help people understand what we want to do with the innovation plan, but more importantly, listen to their ideas about how they can boost innovation in the state.
And I'm sure you've had a chance to talk with Governor Lynch. What advice has he given you?
Oh, I've been so lucky, first of all, to have worked with Governor Lynch when I was in the state Senate. And I think one of the things that is most remarkable about his governorship is how accessible he was, how he brought everybody together and heard all voices before he made a decision. And I certainly want to try to emulate that. And we've had great discussions about the challenges moving forward on the budget. And we'll continue to consult with each other. He's been gracious and open in terms of helping us with the transition. And we're really trying to make it as seamless as possible for the people of the state.
Well, speaking of working together, during the campaign, you did spend a good amount of time criticizing your Republican opponent, Ovid LaMontagne, as being in lockstep with the, quote, Bill O'Brien agenda and the Tea Party agenda. Now you're going to need to work with O'Brien and other lawmakers who consider themselves in line with the Tea Party. So how will you work with them, given all you said in the campaign? Have you tried to repair any of these relations?
Well, I think what's really important about the results of the election is that the people of New Hampshire really restored balance to our state. What I spoke about in the campaign were a series of ideas and actions that really took the state backwards, cutting our university system budget by 50%, for instance, while cutting the cigarette tax. That was a bad idea that hurt the people of New Hampshire. And one of the things we're going to be working on in this budget is finding ways to begin to restore some of that funding to community colleges and to universities, while also asking them to hold tuition stable because college is too expensive. Those are the kinds of things that we need to work on. And I know that with new membership in both the House and the Senate of both political parties, that we're going to work to find balanced solutions for the people of our state.
Have you had a chance to speak with outgoing Speaker O'Brien yet?
I haven't had a chance to speak with a lot of folks in the House and in the Senate yet, but we're working on that. And one of the things I was able to do in the state Senate, and I look forward to doing, is really getting to know other legislators and other people in government. Some people I know well, some people are new. This is all about building relationships and finding what you have in common, and I think we can all do that.
One news item that has really overshadowed the news for the last few weeks has been the tragic shootings in Newtown, Connecticut. Have the events in Newtown in any way affected or changed any legislative priorities for you? For example, where you work on tougher gun control laws or more funding for mental health?
Well, first of all, my heart goes out to the people of Newtown, to the people of Connecticut, and I think every American and people around the world have been overwhelmed by that event and are grieving and mourning as we all should be. I know just recently I picked up my youngest child who is in college, and I think like most parents in New Hampshire and around the country, I hugged her extra tight. So, you know, the first thing we have to do is help each other through the shock and the tragedy of it. I certainly think that we will be making sure that we come together to consider ways we can make our communities and our schools safer and better. That includes looking at our mental health laws. That includes figuring out how to promote gun safety. And that's something I'm very committed to doing.
Well, your inauguration is in just a few short days on January 3rd, and HBR will be covering it. But can you give us a sneak peek in any way about the ceremony or the inauguration speech itself?
Well, I'm just very excited to be able to have the opportunity to speak directly to the people of New Hampshire about why I ran for office, what my vision is moving forward. It's a vision that, you know, I've talked about a lot, which is we need to innovate in all ways in our state, and we're a great state to do that. And we need to come together to do it. I'm very excited by the prospect of being able to see so many sectors and people from New Hampshire all together on inaugural day and really, again, talking about how we can move forward as a state, make us a stronger and better place, and talk a little bit about the fact that New Hampshire's greatest strength is our citizen democracy. And I think this election was really about people standing up and restoring balance to our state, and that's a very exciting thing going forward.
Finally, last question, Governor-elect Hassan. Many politicians talk about, if elected, what they'll do on their first day. What will your top priorities be on your first day as the governor of New Hampshire?
Well, the first and most important thing is making sure that the state is safe. So making sure that we are fully briefed and moving forward on any public safety initiatives that we need to have in mind. One of the things I talked a lot about in the campaign was the innovation plan. So taking steps to make sure we're bringing educators and workers and businesses together so we can talk about how to provide a skilled workforce. And then also making sure that we're attending to a couple of fairly urgent things for the health care of our people, especially around the Medicaid Managed Care Program. One of the things I talked about in the campaign was establishing a commission to oversee the implementation of Medicaid Managed Care, and that's going to be very important too.
Well, I know you've been very busy, Governor-elect Hassan, and thank you so much for taking a few minutes to talk with me. Happy New Year, and look forward to having you on the show in 2013.
Well, thank you. I look forward to it too. Take care.
Maggie Hassan is governor-elect of New Hampshire. She will be inaugurated into office on Thursday, January 3rd, and NHPR will carry her speech. More from our New Hampshire Newsmakers of the Year broadcast after a short break. I'm Keith Shields. This is The Exchange from NHPR.
More of our Newsmakers of the Year coming up on The Exchange on NHPR. And you can keep in touch with NHPR wherever you go with our iPhone app. You can stream us 24/7, download all of our podcasts, and receive news updates throughout the day. Always trying to make it easier for you to stay connected. Download the NHPR app for free at Apple's App Store. New Hampshire weather for today, any sunshine giving way to high cloudiness as we head through the day. Highs near 20 in the North Country, ranging closer to 30 degrees in southern New Hampshire. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and support also comes to us from the Wealth Management Group at Merrimack County Savings Bank. Trust and wealth management services provided by advisors committed to your financial needs, themerrimack.com. And from Concord Search and Retrieval, serving the legal, banking, and real estate communities with corporate filings, document retrieval, and UCC searches. Happy holidays from Concord Search and Retrieval. This is NHPR.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Keith Shields, executive producer for The Exchange. Today, for our 10th annual New Hampshire Newsmakers of the Year broadcast, we're looking at the people and events that made headlines in 2012. Back in 2003, New Hampshire's Episcopal Church made international news by electing the first ever openly gay bishop. Gene Robinson's journey from nomination to consecration was a rough one, and Robinson's rise to the top resulted in a division in the Anglican Church. But over the next 9 years, Robinson settled into his role, leading the state's Episcopalians and shepherding gay rights at a national level. At the end of 2010, Bishop Robinson announced that he would be stepping down by the end of this year. I had a chance to sit down with him to look back at his career and see what might be next for the first openly gay Episcopal bishop. Bishop Gene Robinson, thanks for joining us.
I'm delighted to be here.
So 9 years ago when you started this journey, did you ever think that you'd become the international figure that you've become? I mean, most Episcopal bishops don't have the name recognition that you have.
You know, nothing like this ever crossed my mind. Honestly, we thought this would be controversial for about 3 to 6 months, and then I'd just be the Bishop of New Hampshire. But I think it has happened at a pivotal moment around the issue of the inclusion of gay and lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people, both in denominations and various world faiths, as well as in the nation. And I think it just kind of caught the wave, so to speak, and it's just been a great privilege to feel like I've had a platform to help my people.
Well, you've always said that you want to be New Hampshire's Episcopal bishop, not the gay bishop. So let's look at your time leading New Hampshire's church. What would you say are your top two accomplishments just as the bishop?
When I became the bishop, in the search process for a new bishop, the diocese was pretty clear about wanting someone who would not put forward a whole bunch of programs and then sort of try to strong-arm people into doing them, but actually to help ministry happen at the local level, at the parish level. So I think one of the things I'm proudest of is that my staff has really assisted local congregations, local clergy, local lay leaders in doing their ministry better. So it's been a very localized kind of focus for us. The other thing that I would say is that I believe the Diocese of New Hampshire has become a place where people believe that they will be accepted regardless of who they are, what their circumstances are. The poor and the marginalized, those who have been somewhat pushed aside by the society for whatever reason, I believe have come to know that the Episcopal churches of New Hampshire are places where they will be warmly embraced and welcomed and that they can find a church home.
Okay, so on the other side of that, what do you think didn't get done? You know, what are the things that you wish you had a little more time or space or money to have done that didn't get accomplished?
I think one of my disappointments has been the state of ecumenical relations here in the diocese. We have traditionally had very warm relationships with all the denominations, including the Roman Catholic Church. But I think because the Roman Catholic Church is so opposed to homosexuality and, you know, call people like me intrinsically disordered, they have not really wanted to be related to us in a very meaningful way. And that's a great disappointment for me. I've certainly been willing on my side, but that has just simply not happened. So I think the new bishop will have an opportunity to remedy that situation. And I just had to resign myself to the fact that I probably wasn't the person to move that forward here in the diocese. And I think the other thing is, this is both a positive and negative. I think through my ministry and that of my colleagues in the Episcopal Church, we have really tried to be relevant to the issues that face us as a state. You know, we're part of the Granite State Tax Coalition, which tries to point out that those least able to pay are paying more, and those most able to pay are paying less. And that seems to us, based on biblical standards, to be not the way to run a society. And indeed, Scripture is quite clear in both the Hebrew Scriptures of the Old Testament and the Christian Scriptures of the New that how we care for the most vulnerable will be how God judges us. And I think we have not done a very good job of that in New Hampshire.
I'm wondering at all during the 9 years if you felt hindered at all because of the fact that you were gay kept coming up. Did that take away from anything?
No, actually, you know, it has hardly been a source of discussion here in New Hampshire. In fact, this is the diocese where it has been discussed less than probably any other diocese in the country. They've all been having to deal with it, but let's remember it was the clergy and laity of the Diocese of New Hampshire who called me to be their bishop. So in one sense, this is the one place that I haven't been the gay bishop, but just the bishop.
Well, when you were consecrated as New Hampshire's first openly gay bishop, it created a huge rift in the global Anglican community. So 9 years later, how is that rift? Has it gotten any smaller? Has it gotten larger? Stayed the same?
Well, the Anglican Communion was supposed to explode apart on the day of my consecration. And here we are 9 years later, and the Anglican Communion is still here. We still have real disagreements about this, but the great split that was supposed to have happened still hasn't happened. And in the Episcopal Church here in the United States, if you just read the headlines, you'd think there'd been a big split over this issue. But even those who have left only claim about 100,000 people, and that's in a denomination of over 2 million. So while we mourn the loss of those people, and they would be welcome back anytime, day or night, it still has not been that big a rift. And although there are people in the Episcopal Church around the nation who are not necessarily comfortable with the direction we have moved, they certainly don't see it as a reason to leave their church.
Have you had any chance to come together and have any talks?
Oh, yeah. You know, my relationship with people in the House of Bishops who are quite conservative, my relationship with them has been fantastic. And the conversation has never stopped at that level. And one of the things that I'm proudest of is that we're having these difficult discussions all around the Episcopal Church. And almost in every case, it's been a civil and kind and generous conversation. And so, if anything, we've gotten to know each other better, and we've become closer because of it.
So many were surprised when you made the announcement at the end of 2010 that you were going to step down. Retirement age is 72. You're only 65. So why did you make the decision to leave?
Well, 72 is the mandatory retirement age. You can't serve beyond that. And most bishops retire sometime between 65 and 68. And to be honest, it had never occurred to me to retire anything before 72 until the second openly gay partnered bishop was elected and consecrated in the Diocese of Los Angeles. And all of a sudden, it occurred to me, okay, I could actually do something else. I think without that, I would have stayed in the House of Bishops as the sole openly gay voice. But when Mary Glasspool was consecrated a bishop in Los Angeles, I thought, are there other things that I'd like to do? And the answer was yes, and so I made that decision.
So let's talk about that something else. Your term officially ends on January 5th. What's your first big plans once you retire?
Well, I'm going to take the month of January to sit someplace warm and contemplate this new reality. But on February 1st, I start as a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, which is the think tank in D.C., founded by John Podesta, who was Bill Clinton's chief of staff and ran Obama's transition team. And he wants me to bring a moral voice to the issues that face us as a nation. So I've been given this wide open portfolio to comment from a moral perspective on everything from immigration reform and healthcare reform to poverty and the split between rich and poor, as well as LGBT issues. And I'm really excited about that possibility.
And finally, it was the New Hampshire Episcopalians that put you into your role 9 years ago. So as you leave, what are your last words to those parishioners who elected you?
You know, I leave this position as bishop loving it more than the day I was elected, which is, given all that I've been through, perhaps is a little bit astounding. I love the people of New Hampshire so much, and our congregations are out there living the gospel and proclaiming the love of God for all of God's children. I have felt so privileged and so honored to be in this position and to work with these many Episcopalians around New Hampshire as colleagues in ministry. There has been no honor that I cherish more, and I leave loving them and mourning not getting to see them every day of the week.
Well, Bishop Gene Robinson, it was great speaking with you. Best of luck in your retirement, and all our best in 2013.
Thank you, and Happy New Year to you.
Bishop Gene Robinson is New Hampshire's ninth Episcopal bishop and the first one to serve who's openly gay. His tenure officially comes to an end on January 5th. As 2012 marked the end of a career for one New Hampshire religious figure, it also marked the beginning of another. In late 2011, it was announced that Bishop Peter Anthony Labashi of New York would replace John McCormick as the next spiritual leader of New Hampshire's nearly 288,000 Catholics. Labashi took over a church still recovering from its sex abuse scandal, but also in a year declared by Pope Benedict as a year of faith. I traveled down to the Diocese of Manchester to speak with Bishop Labashi about his first year and his plans for 2013. Bishop Labashi, I know it's Christmas and a very busy time for you, so thank you for taking a few minutes to sit down with me.
Very happy to be with you, Keith. Thanks so much for coming.
So you've been bishop for just about a year now in New Hampshire. What has been the biggest lessons you've learned since you first started serving here?
The biggest lesson I would say is that New Hampshire is quite different from New York. It's much, much more slow in its pace. It's very polite, very kind. Not that New Yorkers are not, but I just find very, very, very different pace of life and a very, very nice place to raise a family.
Another thing about New Hampshire, a lot of studies have showed New Hampshire to be one of, if not the most, non-religious states in the Union. So what kind of challenges has that presented to you, and what are you trying to do to bring more people to the Catholic Church?
I'm glad you asked that, because I don't see that New Hampshire is so non-religious, quite frankly. There is a great love for, a great desire for, a great at-homeness with religion. It's under the surface in some places, but it is truly here. How could people of the earth, as New Hampshireites are, how could people who say live free or die not really have that sense of a freedom inside, in the heart, that says, I worship God, I love God, I go beyond myself into something greater? So this is what we want to do, is scratch that surface. It's almost like witching for water, you know. And when you find it and it starts to bubble up, it is really everywhere. It is a great desire. So what we're going to do, and what I've been doing, is visiting around a good bit of the state. I've been seeing different people. I've been going to whatever I can possibly go to, meeting with people. People have been very, very kind, very, very open. And as we begin to talk about things, religion, politics, the way to grow up in a state such as this, we find that there's an awful lot of comfort among ourselves as we're talking. I think that's the beginning of God talk. And then I see that as the church continues, as I, a Catholic bishop, I will look forward not only to seeing the congregations grow, but every now and again, one of our churches that may be closed because it was, you know, in excess, it'd be great to see this one has to open again because.
Well, about a decade ago, there were some who left the Catholic Church in New Hampshire because of the church sex abuse scandal, and specifically the role that your predecessor, Bishop McCormick, played in that. So what, if anything, have you done to address that so New Hampshire and the Catholic Church can possibly move on even further?
As you well know, this issue has been very, very strong, very powerful in so many areas of society. And many, many different groups, many different people, and in private homes, people are realizing something has been terribly, terribly wrong in our society. The bishops of the United States have come together, and we here in this diocese are very, very eager, and we have been very, very conscientious in the work of protecting and providing a safe environment for our young people. And our Safe Environment Office, as a matter of fact, in the diocese, over 10 years now, has been really working very, very hard. We had an audit very recently of all of our records, and it's been a wonderful thing to see that we came away with flying colors, that things are being watched, programs are in place, we have mechanisms by which people can report if there's anything that they feel is something that should be reported, that there's something odd, you know. We are very, very happy to see that we're becoming, in a sense, a teaching tool for others. And it's something for which we must always, always, always be on guard.
So the church over time is taking at times strong and at times not so strong stands on certain political issues. In the past year, there was a lot of debate around abortion and women's contraception issues. So now that you're at the helm, what is your philosophy in the role of the Catholic Church and what it should play in political, economic, social issues?
No citizen of the United States can turn a blind eye or be mute when there is something that ought to be seen, ought to be said. We have a role to teach. We have a voice, and every citizen has a voice. Our voice also, I think, has a place in the marketplace. So what we want to be able to do is to say, yes, morally and responsibly, the state itself has a stake in its citizens, the unborn and the born. How is it that we can say this one matters, but this one does not matter? This one matters because I can see, or this one matters because I want. This one matters to me, so we'll keep. This one, for whatever reason, doesn't matter. We can't just go by that, because the next thing you know is other people then don't matter. This one is in the way. This one is a burden. This one I don't like for whatever reason. We've been through that in years and years past. We cannot stand by and turn a blind eye or be mute when something like this is possible in a society of selection by choice. Other issues, too. if we say, this is what we believe, but not only what we believe, but why we believe it. Many times, before we can say why, people turn away from us and don't want to hear. Well, you've told us what you believe, but that's all we care. But we have very, very understandable and legible teachings on why we believe. We can communicate that, and we would hope for a voice to be able to say why we believe or hold what we hold.
So will you be more active in speaking out against some of those issues that you feel the strongest about?
I will be able to speak when spoken to. How about that? I will speak when spoken to and always hope that people will come and say, Bishop, we'd like you to speak about this. Bishop, we'd like to hear what you have to say about it. And I'll be happy to respond, just like we are today. This is a wonderful opportunity. And I think we'll always want to be so respectful and so aware and be able to talk as brothers and sisters. That I think I would like to do.
Great. Well, over the past year, what would you say has been your greatest accomplishment as the leader of the Diocese of Manchester?
My greatest accomplishment has been, I think, to be able to visit so many areas of the state and the diocese, all the way up to West Stewartstown and Berlin and parts in between, all the way down to Salem and Nashua, over to the west at Keene, and all the way over to Rye and Hampton. When I first came, I said, I want to take the first year to learn what it's like here, what the people are like here, what they're doing, what life is like, how the faith is lived here. I think my greatest accomplishment was to be true to that promise and to visit, to hear, to listen. And I'm so glad I was able to do that. Now I must take that knowledge and put it to good use.
And any idea what that good use is going to be?
Oh, some of the things we already talked about. Filling up them churches. And dialoguing well with my brothers and sisters here in the state of New Hampshire. In July, we had a great pilgrimage up to Berlin. 1,200 people from around the 1,200 people from around the state came up to Berlin in buses and cars and whatnot. And we're doing it again this coming July 26th. So we're going to be doing more of those pilgrimages, more of those prayer sessions, so that the religion of the household, kitchen religion, prayer around the kitchen table, comes out into the community and into the church. And I think that's a beautiful thing to see.
Well, it sounds like a lot, and I know you're very busy, so thank you for taking a few minutes with me, Bishop Labashi.
Keith, thank you so very much. It was kind of you to come. Eager, I wish you a very happy, blessed new year. And all of the very, very best, huh?
The same to you.
Thank you.
Bishop Peter Labashi is the 10th and current bishop of the Diocese of Manchester. I'm Keith Shields. We'll return with more from our New Hampshire Newsmakers of the Year broadcast after a short break. This is The Exchange from NHPR.
More of our Newsmakers of the Year on The Exchange coming up here on NHPR, then a 10 on the Diane Rehm Show, a reader's review of Years of Wonders by Geraldine Brooks. New Hampshire weather for today, any sunshine will become filtered by some high cloudiness. Today's highs 20 in the north, 30 in the south. Tonight, New Year's Eve, lots of clouds across the state with a few flurries over the White Mountains and through northern New Hampshire. Lows tonight 5 to 10 above in the north country, ranging to 20 to 25 degrees across southern New Hampshire. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and support also comes to us from St. Mary's Bank, the nation's first credit union, helping New Hampshire families and businesses grow and prosper for over 100 years. Season's greetings from St. Mary's Bank. And from the Frost School, announcing its new change to Plymouth State University's Division of Online and Continuing Studies, sending best wishes for achieving your goals in the new year. This is NHPR.
One day I'll make a difference and do the world some good. Leave my mark with what I've done as an inspiration would.
Greetings, I'm Madafo. Join me for a salute to our children and a celebration of Kwanzaa on a season's griot from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on NHPR.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Keith Shields, executive producer for The Exchange.
Today, for our 10th annual New Hampshire Newsmakers of the Year broadcast, we're looking back at those in the Granite State who made headlines in 2012 and exploring what's happened since. ...2012 included some health scares as well. There was a fungal meningitis outbreak due to tainted syringes linked to a pharmaceutical compounding site in Massachusetts. And back in May, doctors at New Hampshire's Exeter Hospital began to notice an unusual number of patients diagnosed with the disease hepatitis C. What they had in common was that they all had recently received treatment at the hospital. An investigation began, and in the end, 31-year-old medical technician David Kwiatkowski was charged with stealing drugs and infecting 32 patients in New Hampshire with the disease. Kwiatkowski currently awaits trial, while many in the state are scratching their heads, wondering how this happened and how it can be stopped from happening again. Exchange host Laura Kanoy sat down with Dr. Jose Montero, public health director for the state of New Hampshire.
Dr. Montero, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure to be here.
Well, in all your years in public health here in the Granite State, have we ever seen anything like this where criminal action leads to a number of people being infected with a serious disease? It's awful.
Yes, it has been quite a terrible situation for the patients, for the hospital, for the communities where these events happened. And no, I haven't had this experience here in New Hampshire before.
Walk us through what happened, Dr. Montero. And I know there's some things you can't talk about because there are criminal investigations ongoing. But as far as we know, what happened? A certain individual worked as a medical technician. And what did this individual, we think, do?
Drug diversion, by definition, is taking a medication that was prescribed or intended for somebody else and using it in a different person or yourself. From what we know and from the literature, people who has drug addictions and is doing drug diversion can be really creative in the ways that they trick people to think that they are there performing a function or whatever. And when somebody gets distracted by their work or concentrated in what they are doing, takes the medications. Now, if they just take the medication and go away, that's bad, but nobody is infected. But they cannot do that because somebody will realize that the medication is not there. So what they need to do is replace it. And by that, they can bring a syringe that is emptied or full of water or saline solution or whatever, or inject themselves part of the medication and put back the syringe. That is the situation that creates the risk, because when you inject yourself, you contaminate the needle with blood. And that's why it gets transmitted from one person to one person.
A few years ago in Colorado, a similar situation came up. Another medical technician who was infected with hepatitis C did the same thing, injected herself with drugs, and then allowed those infected needles to be used on patients. And there have been other cases like this before, Dr. Montero, in other states. Why didn't we learn from this?
We thought we did, and that's part of the sadness of this situation. We know that drug diversion is a risk, and it's an event that may happen in a healthcare setting. That's the reason why we have policies and procedures in place. And if you ask, every facility has them, because everybody knows that. Now, how you implement the policies and procedures is where the trick of this is. We all, as human beings, kind of grow confident and sometimes compliant. And, oh, somebody else is taking care and somebody else look at this. So you don't assume that the people that is coming to work is going to do that. But if we lose that specific acuity in looking all the time as if it's a risk, that's when this type of things may happen. I am fully convinced that what happened here could have happened anywhere else. Unfortunately, it did happen in New Hampshire. I am incredibly proud of the quality of the work that we did, because actually we uncovered a national situation that impacted 7 states. We stopped here because we did the thorough job of looking at what happened, who is the person, notifying others, and as you know, there are confirmed cases that match this event in other states, because we didn't left and we don't want to leave any stone unturned to make sure that we are protecting all of the people here.
The person charged, David Kwiatkowski, also had been in trouble before in earlier jobs. In Arizona, for example, he was found passed out with a needle. He'd been fired from that job. What's wrong with the record keeping? And I'm not just talking about New Hampshire, but systemically, nationally, that this person wasn't stopped before he got here.
A lot of things are wrong. You see that for physicians and for nurses, there are national databases. But that's where it stops. We don't have a national system to keep records of anybody else. And I do understand this is our system, this is our federalism at work, and it has huge advantages, but it may have disadvantages like that, that we don't know what's happening with employees who are, or not just the travelers, but people who move from one state to the next, the type of license that they have, the type of issues that they had elsewhere. Certainly, we need to do better as a country. That's something that we cannot manage or change just in New Hampshire. But unless we address this type of things nationally and then the states enforce a national standard, it's not going to change.
The state itself, your department, was also criticized in this for the way it handled notification of patients and the testing clinics that you set up. There was some confusing information put out there. What did your department, Dr. Montero, do wrong in this?
It is an unprecedented type of response, and we don't do direct patient clinical work. So we are not set to notify hundreds of people at once in an event like this. So early on, we have delays. Maybe it was 24, 48 hours. Some people will say, well, that's nothing. Well, when you are waiting for a diagnosis that may change your life, that's a lot. And we do acknowledge and recognize that. We apologize for that and change the system. And involve a lot of other employees and created a system to be able to properly and quickly notify the results. But the other side of this, and it's an issue of expectations, science is not where the public think it is. There is no perfect test for hepatitis C. Some of the tests require 2, 3, 4, 5 different steps for confirmation. There are some tests that we sent months ago and we're still waiting for a final response from CDC. So it's not that we don't want to give the results at a minute notice to a person. It's just that this is the procedures, the testing, and you can explain that to everybody. But when your level of anxiety is so high because the stakes are quite high, you want everything done today. So yes, there are things that we could have done better on that end. There are things that are just the nature of the test.
What do you think we've learned overall from this hepatitis C crisis as a state, our hospitals, all of us really?
A lot of things. The healthcare quality needs quite upfront on everybody's minds. Not just from a regulatory side, but what do we expect from our healthcare facilities? And it's not just the hospitals, it's the doctor's office, it's the mental health center, it's the community health center, the nursing home. What do we expect from our healthcare and how do we get that? And so we need to look at defining those outcomes, defining how we pay for those outcomes, and defining the transparency needs. Now, we know that writing a policy or a procedure is not enough, that we need to be able to have clear follow-ups with a lot of investment and empowerment of people to call the shots when they see something wrong. And I'm not talking about this particular event or hospital, but this brought up several different things. We got a lot of calls from people from everywhere talking about this. Well, I complain about this employee or that employee and nothing happens. And we brought that message to the hospitals and they are taking it incredibly seriously. The Hospital Association is helping us to craft that, and the Healthcare Quality Commission is going to play a key role. So it's not just about Exeter Hospital. It's about what has happened in our healthcare delivery system as a country and learn from that.
Dr. Montero, thank you for being with us and Happy New Year.
Thank you and Happy New Year to you, and hope that it's a really Happy New Year for all of us.
Dr. Jose Montero is Public Health Director for the state of New Hampshire. David Kwiatkowski pleaded not guilty on December 3rd. His trial is not expected to begin until the fall of 2013. Finally, in 2012, New Hampshire lost a famous political figure. Warren Rudman was a lifelong Republican and two-term U.S. Senator. He fought against budget deficits and for campaign finance. He was the founder of the Concord Coalition and was instrumental in the nomination of Supreme Court Justice David Souter. But Rudman may be best known for being a collaborator, a true bipartisan, many had called him, who listened to both sides and was more than willing to change his mind if convinced. To look back at his life, I talked with another former senator and successor to Rudman, Judd Gregg. Senator Gregg, remind us of your personal relation with the late senator. When did you work with him?
Kathy and my friendship with Warren goes back a long way. In fact, in my case, his father and my grandfather ran small furniture manufacturing businesses right across the street from each other in Nashua. And I've known Warren for all my life. Nashua, when I was growing up, was a small town, and everybody knew everybody. And certainly the Rudmans were big players in the town, and Warren was always a larger-than-life figure.
Well, in the remembrances of him over the last month, people have used the words maverick, bulldog, oracle to describe the late senator. They've called him gruff, pugnacious, and caring. So what were the things that you remember most fondly about Senator Rudman?
Oh, I think what you liked about Warren, or at least I liked about him, was his infectious enthusiasm. There was no issue that he wasn't willing to give you his opinion on with definitiveness, but he did it a nice way. I mean, there was not an arrogance about it. It was just, you know, I got this opinion on this, and I'm going to tell you what it is, and you better listen to me because I know what I'm talking about. It was just fun to be around because he was always had such energy and enthusiasm for whatever he was doing.
Is there a specific story or two that you can think about with this sentiment in mind?
Well, I think one of our favorites, Kathy and mine, was they were about to tear down a building called the John Hay Estate. It had been given to the National Wildlife Service, and it's up on Lake Sunapee. And it's a beautiful old turn-of-the-century, 19th-century home, and it was the center of a lot of very important things that happened in our state. John Hay lived there, who was Lincoln's secretary and then went on to be Secretary of State under Roosevelt and McKinley. And it was a place where a lot of people used to come for the summer. And the Fish and Wildlife didn't want a building, so they were going to tear it down. So Kathy, who was first lady at the time, found out about this and got really concerned about it. And so she called up Warren and said, "They can't tear this building down. It's a historic building, and we got to save it." So between the two of them, who are both forces of nature, they basically told Fish and Wildlife, "You're not going to do this. We're going to straighten this out." And it was taken care of. And as a result, a very important piece of New Hampshire's history, and America's history for that matter, was preserved. Because he stepped in and basically said to Fish and Wildlife, "No, you're not going to tear this building down."
That's great. And so you succeeded him in the Senate. Take us back to that time, Senator Gregg. What kind of shoes did you feel you needed to fill as you took the baton from him in the Senate?
Well, I felt that Warren carried on what I saw as a very important tradition. People like Stiles Bridges, Norris Cotton, Warren Rudman, they had brought what I call New Hampshire common sense and Yankee frugality to Washington, and that was the way I intended to try to serve, very much in that footstep. You know, you look at an issue, you apply common sense to the issue, you're not dogmatically ideological, but you are totally committed to fiscal restraint and having a solvent government. And those were the hallmarks of Warren Rudman and a lot of the folks who served before him in the Senate from New Hampshire, and I wanted to carry that tradition on. Hopefully I was able to.
As people remembered Senator Rudman over the past month, they've listed a lot of his accomplishments, a pioneer for campaign finance reform, the Graham Rudman deficit reduction plan, his leadership in the Iran-Contra investigations, and his influence in engineering the appointment of Justice David Souter. So out of those and all the other accomplishments, what would you say will be the one single one that the late senator will be remembered most for?
I don't think it'll be a single one, although he certainly had an impact on a lot of very big and important issues. I think what he's remembered for is looking at complex issues and trying to find solutions, and then when he felt he had a solution, driving it to fruition. He was a finisher. He was a guy who understood that to govern, you have to compromise, but you also have to reach cloture, that you don't give away your ideological beliefs to do that, but you've got to be aggressive, and you've got to be willing to make the tough calls, and you've got to be willing to step on a few toes if you're going to effectively govern. And I just think he's a style that was very important and is very memorable. If you talk to people who served with him, they all remember his style. It was unique, really. It was because he was so aggressively committed to getting things done.
And he was also remembered by a lot of people as being a, quote, true bipartisan. What do you think made him that way?
He wanted to govern. He wasn't there to shout. He was there to get things done. You know, there's two types of people who serve in the Congress. Well, not two types. There are thousands of types, I guess. But, I mean, people fall into a couple of categories. One of the categories are folks who go there and they shout from the corners and they don't get anything done, but they make their constituencies who they speak to happy and they raise their money as a result of that and run their PACs. And then there's folks who understand that you don't have to give up your beliefs to get things done, but you do have to go across the aisle. Probably the best example of that was Ted Kennedy. He used to want to govern. Warren Rudman was another person who understood that you can't govern from the corners. You got to get into the middle of the ring.
So in kind of speaking about that, many who have been remembering the late senator's bipartisanship are also lamenting the loss of it in today's political arenas. Do you think he would give any sort of advice to these new challenges around bipartisanship?
Well, I think people who go to Washington should go there to want to get things done. And you can't get things done by ramming things down other people's throats. Our system is not parliamentary. In a parliamentary system, the majority party can do whatever it wants. In our system, it's checks and balances, and you have to reach a compromise in order to govern. That doesn't mean you have to give up your values or your philosophy. It just means you've got to be able to work across the aisle to get things done. And so if you want to go to Washington to get things done, to govern, then you're going to have to be willing to step out of the corners and get into the middle of the ring.
Any final words or memories about your colleague and lifelong friend, the late Senator Warren Rudman?
Oh, Warren was just a very special person for Kathy and I to know in our lives. And the state of New Hampshire is very lucky to have him as a public servant. And he really did have a very significant impact on good governance. And he will be greatly missed, not only because of his ability to contribute to the making our country better, but also because he was just a great guy to be around.
Well, thank you so much for taking a few minutes with me, Senator Gregg, and a Happy New Year to you.
Same to you.
Judd Gregg is a former New Hampshire governor, congressman, and he succeeded Warren Rudman in the Senate. Senator Warren Rudman passed away on November 19th. He was 82. Well, that wraps up The Exchange for 2012, and we hope you keep listening in the coming year. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The producer is Ellen Grimm, our engineer is Dan Colgan, and we'd like to thank our interns for the year, Samantha Johnson, Karen Gull, Ryan Lassard, Emily Johnson, Tim Camerato, and Claudia Camerino. And thanks to our incredible and dedicated volunteer, Priscilla Malcolm. We also like to thank our fill-in hosts this year, Dean Spiliotis, Wayne Lesperance, and Brady Carlson. And I'm Keith Shields, executive producer for The Exchange. Laura Canoy returns to her seat on Tuesday, January 2nd. You're listening to The Exchange on NHPR, and Happy New Year.
Exchange. It gets New Hampshire talking, whether it's schools or alternative fuels, the economy or astronomy, transportation, immigration, or what it means to be first in the nation. It's been said that the public interest is best served by the free exchange of ideas. I'm Laura Canoy. Be part of our exchange weekday mornings at 9 here on NHPR.
The Diane Rehm Show.